the confluence between boards and ministers? Where can we draw the line between ministerial overreach and intervention? Was the minister's decision to dissolve the board at SA Tourism overreach, or could things have been done differently? Joining me on today's show is Dr. Simo Lushaba of the Institute of Directors and Mr. Wayne Duvenage of Outer to help us figure out what are the blurred lines between accounting authorities and the executive roles, and what are the responsibilities that South Africans should be looking out for when it comes to boards and their ministers. Gentlemen, after all that exciting start to the day, thank you very much for taking the time to come and have this conversation with me. And I think on the lips of almost all South Africans, suddenly we all know about accounting authorities and directors and boards. And because once again in the news, here we are, a minister having a disagreement with her board, the executives, the board. And I thought, who better to have this conversation with? Dr. Simo, let's start with you. Is there a problem in state-owned enterprises and the way that they engage boards? Because we don't hear this in the private sector, this fighting over who's who and the firing of everybody and.
Yeah, I think there seems to be a problem. I mean, they say the start of solving any problem is acknowledging it. So if you don't realize there's a problem, then you are never going to solve it. So I really think there is a problem. I think the model, which we call the company model, which by the way comes from the military, it's not a model that doesn't exist anywhere, where you've got ownership control, which is where your shareholders are, and where the purpose, which is the mandate, is determined. And then you've got another level, which is directing, which is where you then say, what is the strategy through which you are going to fulfill this purpose? You then look at the policy framework to guide us as we fulfill this model, to say this is the pathway, and then finally monitor and oversee. And then lastly, you've got the executing level, which are the generals will be at your...
Hence the word executive.
Yeah, but the generals will be at your strategy level, directing level, because they are the people... In fact, the whole issue of strategy comes way back with the Greeks, where they actually called it strategos, where they thought it's the art of the generals, it's the game the generals play. Once the commander-in-chief, which is the ownership control, has declared a war. Because you can't go fight a different war. You fight the war that was declared, right? So if you think of it in a company, the mandate is the war that you are out there to fight. But the generals then determine the strategy. How are you going to fight the war? It's not for the commander-in-chief to tell you how you're going to fight the war. But then you have the commanders and everybody else in the military who goes out there and fights the war. So the generals don't go and fight the war, because then they'll get caught in the crossfire and we lose the war. So that's where the logic comes in. So the generals are the directors and the executives are the executors.
They're the soldiers on the ground. They are the
commanders that lead your execution, and then management and employees, all of them are the soldiers on the ground. Yeah.
I like this analogy because fighting, we're so good at it, and we see often, and when you've been very vocal over the years around this kind of breakdown of the shareholder, particularly in state-owned enterprises, government being represented by the minister and the disagreements that they seem to have and who or where who makes the decisions of where things are done and how they are done. You've been very vocal over the past couple of years, and this conversation I really want us to anchor around what we're watching play out again at tourism, right? Is there something that, in your view, the minister or this particular board could have done differently for a different outcome rather than this kind of fight that we are watching them?
Oh, yeah. No, without a doubt. The minister could have done a lot differently. So let me start by saying that's a great analogy, by the way. So thanks for that, because it does explain it. And there's a little bit of a difference in government in some of the institutions, not all, where the PFMA sort of clouds things because the directors and the operations are beholden to the Public Finance Management Act, which is not really within the Companies Act, and not all of them, only some of them. So we are trying, by the way, bringing a, what do you call it, there's a lacuna in the law that allows directors on government entities that are not operating in the corporate space, such as the CETAs, where the boards cannot be held delinquent. We believe they should be if they, because they're fulfilling a similar role to directors on company boards. So in this instance, Patricia de Lille, as the minister, should not be getting involved in the operational matters, because then she usurps the work, and she gets in the way of it. And if they fail, they can't point to the minister, which they should be able to do, if they're trying to carry out her instructions or interference. And that's what's been happening here. Why there's a board is to make sure that there's good governance and oversight, so that if something goes wrong, the minister doesn't get sucked in to the operational matters. The board then starts holding the executive to account. So as the doctor says, if there's a war on and the people are running rogue and not doing it, the generals get involved, say, what are you doing? Get back on track. This is the strategy. And she has just completely ignored the board, completely.
Earlier we were talking about this idea of a duty of care. And what then? What's the demarcation of this, of a board versus a minister versus the executive? What are these demarcations? And you deal with this at the Institute of Directors all the time. What are these demarcations? Are they clear? Does everybody know what they are?
So I will bring you another analogy at the end of this particular question. But duty of care means you will act with care, skill, and diligence. So you are left with the organization as a board to look after it with care, skill, and diligence, which means you will prioritize the organization. You will care for the organization. And it goes hand in hand with your fiduciary duties. So whilst exercising your duties of faith, which is of the fiduciary duties and trust, you will also demonstrate care, skill, and diligence. What does that mean? It means you will not leave the organization destitute. And the reason I was actually raising it earlier was also the fact that this is an organization that had lost the chairperson, the CEO is on suspension. I understand the company secretary was also on suspension at the same time. You would then expect that the duty of care, skill, and diligence places a responsibility on the board, not to just walk away and say, we can't hold any meeting during this period, because the minister's issue is we have clause 18.2 that says your special meetings can only be called by the chair, right? Now, the reality of it is, you would have broken a law as well if you did not, therefore, look after the company, meet and talk about the developments in the organization, whatever developments that would have needed that. So the board was damned if it did and damned if it didn't.
A rock and a hard place for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the reality is, where is the substantive responsibility lying? The suspensive responsibility cannot be on the procedure, because 18.2 is a procedure. Now, you asked a very interesting question earlier on of what could the minister have done differently.
Yeah.
First of all, the minister should have appointed a deputy chair.
Yeah.
Not even for this situation. The deputy chair carries a responsibility to mediate when there are disputes between the board and the chair. Mm-hmm. In this case, it seems to have been the case from mid-July.
Yeah.
But you wonder who then mediated, who did this. And somewhere in the Act, the Tourism Act, I just forget the clause now, they also, I think it's 16.2, they also say that the chair and the deputy chair. So the act itself recognizes that there should be a deputy chair. But we have not really understood why the deputy chair was not appointed.
She hasn't explained herself on that.
She's not. Yeah. Even in Parliament, I see that they asked her the question.
Yeah.
She spoke about something else, but did not say why she didn't appoint the deputy chair.
Exactly.
So the board was left in a situation where it has a duty in law, but it also has a law, which, by the way, is also problematic in the state entities. I was part of a presidential review committee back in around 2011. We submitted our report in 2012, where we actually recommended that in the state, you don't have a governance act. And therefore, governance is regulated through all sorts of founding acts for different entities, which are contradicting themselves. And therefore, you do not have anything that seems to align. PFMA is not a governance act. It does recognize governance, but it's a finance management act.
Mm-hmm.
It was there because of issues in management of finance. When they, in 2018, appointed the governance council, or the council that was a presidential council that worked with the now extinct DPE, Department of Public Enterprises, they said one of the priorities was to develop that act. And I think that's part of the chaos that we have, because we have different laws that all dabble into governance. And you look at them and you wonder, why? Why did they include this clause in this law? But in another law, there isn't anything that talks. So I don't understand why they even in the first place regulated the convening of meetings. In terms of the special meetings. But even if they did that, should then have addressed what happens when there is no chair.
Yeah.
And, I mean, over the years, we have seen, you talk about a relooking these governance from 2011 already. I mean, over the years, we've seen SAA has had these issues.
Mm.
A couple of months ago, chairpersons of the CETAs have had these issues. Is there... And often when this conversation comes up, because state-owned enterprises operate like companies,
mm-hmm.
and often we talk about King,
yeah.
King 4, which is for companies, most directors within the private sector understand their roles and the demarcation between non-executives and executives.
Mm.
Is there too much confusion with regard to what part of the chair should be sitting in state-owned enterprises, private sector companies, or should it all be standardized? What's your view?
It's generally standardized from the point of view that you have the shareholders, you have this board, which is should be filled more with non-executive directors. You have a couple of executive directors, normally the CEO and the CFO, but they are there by invitation. So there's this board that's not involved in the day-to-day operating. It's just overseeing and asking questions. And and that's the methodology or the way it is supposed to be, even in those boards that are slightly outside of the Companies Act, like the CETA boards. But on this SA Tourism Board, the first thing, as the doctor said, was she didn't appoint a deputy. So she was remiss for 9 months. And she was reminded and asked, when are you going to appoint the deputy? And she didn't do that, gave a real weak excuse. Second thing, the big issue where she could have done things differently is not intervened in operational matters. She is known to be in the office of the SA Tourism, engaging with the executives, to the extent that when SA Tourism had a strategic session, she doesn't invite the board. Now, this is the board that's got to oversee.
Is that the general?
Yeah, the strategy. They've got to oversee and make sure. And they're not invited. They're not part of the strategic sessions. Like, no, we don't need you there. I'm the minister and we're having a session. I'm having the session with the executives team and the operational team. That's taboo. And then when they do have a split with the chair, because she started to engage with the board through the chair, the board was saying to the chair, we need your concurrence on matters that have to happen with the CEO and that. Nothing was going through to the the minister. They kept asking, what is the minister saying? Why is she taking so long? Have you asked? They very quickly learn over a few months that he is actually not playing. He is fulfilling his fiduciary duty. So they have a vote of no confidence in him. At a meeting where he, while he was there, all of them, unanimous, they write to the minister on the 17th of July saying, this is what's happened. Now, you need to do something here. We suggest, obviously, it's your prerogative that we that you appoint a new or acting chair. But we can't. This is not working for this board. Obviously, the writing's on the wall. The chairperson resigns 2 weeks later on the 31st of July. The board's got no chair.
No chairperson, can't have a special
meeting. The minister could have immediately appointed an acting chair right away there and then. Had she had a deputy, yes, would have resolved all of that straight away. She doesn't do that. And instead she goes on some technicality, which we now hear is she's very weak. And now this has been taken to court on the 14th of September. It's going to be heard. The board has challenged her. We've seen Popo Molefe on the PRASA board do the same thing to Dupuy Peters, who disbanded that board irrationally. And the court said, you can't do that, minister. Reinstated that board. Now, where do you go if they reinstate it?
And all this, what of the confidence of the, not even the executives, but even just the workers within the organization when there's this kind of disarray between boards and executives?
As you say, there's no CEO, there's no secretary, there's no chair. It's a temporary board, it's in limbo.
I think you're asking a very fundamental question, though, where you started with the boards. One of the major problems, I think, that makes this an issue in the state is how we deal with power. Our relationship with power somewhat brings certain problems. When I have power, I then can exercise this power anyhow, and I don't have to account. Here is the issue for me. And it happens throughout the state. When boards are appointed, I've never seen a report that says, I appointed Simo because these are the qualities he has, and this is what he's going to deliver for us. That's why he's the best South African to take our South African entity forward. And that's lack of accountability. Because when things go wrong, it's only then that we go back and say, but why was Simo there? What was he doing? So I, for instance, don't know why the chair would have been under pressure, as Wayne is saying. What was his qualities? I don't know. We should have known that from the time he was appointed.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing the person. I do not know him. He may have been the right person. He may not. But why are we not told right from inception? If we had not had, through leaks with the sitters, the appointments of the chairs, we would have had them sitting there as chairs. Nobody tells you why.
Exactly.
And I think that's where, because I always say to people, governance is not something you remember when things have gone wrong. It's a way of life. It's something that you do. But in this particular situation, we find ourselves generally, people who have power don't account. And accountability goes back to commitment. What are you committed to? Because when someone else asks you a question, it no longer matters, because out of your own commitment, you've asked yourself those questions many times and even harder ones. But if you are not operating at that, when someone asks you, you say, why are you asking me that question? And then you flex your powers to avoid that accountability. So one of the major things is that we don't deal with accountability until something, wheels have come off. And that for us is the problem. We cannot, and that's why it's not a good governance system when you do things like that.
Yeah, and it happens too often.
It does happen often. I mean, you think about when Faith Mutambi was minister at communications and with the SABC board.
Yeah.
You think about as far back as, Dudumieni and SAA.
Yeah.
And all of this
Denel, Sanral.
denounce.
So this to me is political interference. People are placed on boards for reasons. They're not there, as Simo says, for the governance, oversight, financial expertise, engineering expertise, if it's an entity that requires it, like Eskom as well. Eskom's board at one stage was extremely weak, missing with all these requirements that it needed for oversight. So then you've got to ask yourself the question, why is this? Why do you do this every time, Mr. Minister, Mrs. Minister? And it is, from where we see it, deliberate. We see it in the CETAs heavily so. It's a deliberate ploy to make sure that that board is not going to exercise the oversight. And the chairperson, who's been appointed by the ministers in the past, are put there for that reason. Enough board members to vote against those who want to stand up for what something is going wrong. And the CEO gets away with so much, and the Auditor General picks it up. So you have qualified audits. And what happens? I mean, if you get a qualified audit in the corporate world, that person, that CEO, is gone.
Gone. Fired.
But year after year, nothing happens. So you've got to ask the board, well, you're remiss in your duty. They're all delinquent, quite frankly. I mean, if we had enough money, we'd go after every single one of those people and have them declared delinquent, never to sit on a board again. It just costs millions of rands to do that.
And talking of boards, Dr. Simo, I am very interested in the kinds of experience, expertise, and qualities that are required to be a board member. Is it just anybody can be a board member? What does it take to be a board member? Because you raised the issue of we never know who these people are up until we hear that the wheels have fallen off. When we don't hear the wheels have fallen off, we never know. Yeah. And they just carry on quietly receiving their board fees.
Look, there's a number of considerations. There are general considerations which would cover issues of integrity, issues of ethical leadership, issues of what have you achieved in the past in what you've done, right? Then there will be specific issues that relate to that particular organization and industry, which you would also imagine if you are to appoint a general in an army, you're not just going to take anyone who walks freely in the street and say, come and be the general for the army. You'd look at experience in the army. You'd look at what have you achieved? What colors have you achieved? So the same issue. So we look at the makeup of the organization, right? And then you say, if this is the makeup of the organization, take SAA, for instance, as an airline, they will definitely have to be technical ability to understand what we do to those aeroplanes. There will have to be ability to know what pilots do. There will have to be ability to know what customer services is, financial management, because all of those are part of the makeup of SAA, IT, digitization. So you look at the elements that make up what needs to be done. Human resources, because it's an organization that mans a lot of its operations through human resources. And you would look at your transaction management, for instance, because that's what they are. So the makeup will also be justified based on what are the core competencies that you require in the organization. Then you look at the environment. What are the external environmental factors, stakeholder relationship management? Where is the industry itself going? What are the new technologies that are emerging? Does this person understand all of that? So you corporate governance, does this person understand what corporate governance is? Has he worked in that environment? Particularly when you're going to put them as chair of a board so that they know what it entails. That's the terminology we normally use. And you then go to your committees. For instance, you need to have at least three independent non-executives who know what audit and audit matters are. Some of the boards in the state entity, in the state environment, would end up without even a single accountant.
Yeah.
And you wonder, why was this board appointed like this? In some cases, one accountant who then becomes the chair of the audit committee. And the rest of the audit committee members would even tell you, we don't know what this thing entails. Yeah. We need to be trained. We need to be told, So because you need to be able to read that financial statement with meaning, you know, you need to be able to make out of the numbers what they're saying, what they are telling you.
Yeah.
in addition to what the auditors are going to present to yourself. So there is a lot of thinking. And one of the things that I want to also share here is when you look at the Zondo recommendations, one of the things that comes out there is that in the appointment of the boards in the state, it was recommended that you must have a panel of stakeholders that also interact with these individuals. It's important, one, so that the stakeholders have confidence in the people that make the shortlist. But secondly, they bring all these diverse elements. Mm. Some of the boards do that. In water, for instance, when I was CEO of Rand Water some years back, we used to have the Chamber of Mines then, which is the Minerals Council now, SALGA, BUSA, represented in the panel and the department, so that you get an input that comes from the different stakeholders. We even recommended now that we should include professional bodies like SAICA, for instance, so that when you evaluate accountants, because also their experience matters. You may actually be an accountant, but you have not dealt with it in the manner that we actually address it in this particular entity. Those people will bring that in the assessment, so that when then you say, here is a board member, you know you've done a good job in understanding what value they bring to the board. So for me, that's very, very important. And it, in many cases, we've actually come across board members who say, well, my name was in the nominations list and we don't really know what happened in between because there are no interviews in some cases. Yeah, there's no standardization in the system. And I'm happy that when the final list came up, my name was there.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow. But what does this then mean? When I'm thinking about all the noise that we are currently making, we're having this very loud and noisy exchange, even as citizens, we need better sight. Is this something that needs to be changed at policy level? Is this a legislative thing that needs to change? Or is it simply political will that needs to change?
If we could get good professional oversight right of these state entities, it changes everything. That chairperson and those boards are powerful. They either can look away from the misdeeds taking place or they can hold the executive to account. Those are the two things. And if they don't hold the executive to account and you get qualified audit after qualified audit, billions of rands, billions missing, well, then that's how we fail as an entity and as a country. So we got a lot of work to do, and I don't see why it's so difficult. The political will should be to root out inefficiency and corruption. But it doesn't happen. I can assure you now that there are people on these boards existing in many of these entities that are not fit for role, that have not been held accountable for qualified audits year after year, looked away on grand corruption, which we've highlighted to the boards. There's an issue here. The CEO needs to answer, and they don't do anything. They don't even call for an independent inquiry. And we give hard evidence, by the way. And while that's happening, the CEO and the CFO are firing people who are getting in the way. These are big flags for the board to say, hey.
I'm saying that part that you are referring to of firing people who are getting in the way is huge at the moment.
It's massive.
We just had a conversation with whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are at the next level of that. But you have people who
refuse to
get
sign
told
the,
you must
invoice,
sign this, you must do this, because the perpetrators don't want to be implicated. And again, it's use of power. So they go to junior people and say, you must do this, you must do that. Yeah. When you refuse, you're out in the street.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't even need to take you through a hearing or anything like that. I've seen cases, for instance, where a person will be put on a precautionary suspension, right?
On trumped up charges.
And then an investigation happens and he's cleared, right? But later, when this individual is looking for work elsewhere, they will tell those people that, no, he was suspended. And then that person, on the basis of the fact that
they were on a precautionary suspension would be denied employment.
Yeah,
without any finding, without any process that found them to have been, because they were not. It was trumped up. So so you're getting a situation where people who are ethical, people who are upright, people who will not have wrong done through them are actually being given these labels of suspensions, and they are made to sit at home and are denied any other opportunity in the mainstream of the economy. Even when they try to do business, some of them are not allowed to do that. That's very huge, and that's victimization.
Massive. And some of them who just don't want to lose their jobs get sucked into the system, and they sign. And they know that if they don't sign, they lose their jobs. So they sign, but now they're implicated because they become the fall people when, as Seymour says, hold on, I didn't, the perpetrator, the real perpetrator, I didn't sign this. That admin clerk or manager signed it. Mm. They must go. They must go into a hearing. And we've seen that often where they bring up trumped up charges against the whistleblower, eventually says, I can't handle this more. I'm going to do a protected disclosure, and blows the whistle. They say, no, but she's the corrupt person. They turn everything against the individual. It's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. One of the things that's missing in our system, in my view at least, Wayne, is when a person is in that situation, they generally have no one to go to say, this is the situation in which I am. This is what's being done to me. You find yourself completely on your own. Yeah. And because you then on your own, you become weak. I've seen that right up to boards. There are board members who find themselves in situations where it's untenable. But the only option they have is to leave or continue with what they're being asked to do. There is no area or authority that they can rely upon. I saw the other day that the president is saying that the is that CASAC, the corruption
constitutional
there's a corruption advisory
NACEC.
They're now saying let's have an anti-corruption unit. Maybe we need structures like that, but we need to also protect them. They need to actually be protected, because a number of times when you start good structures that will actually do work for you, later you find that they've also been decapacitated. They don't have the capacity they need to do their work. So somehow we've got a lot of work to do, because the strength of a country is in the institutions. If the institutions collapse, if we lose the institutions, individuals will always falter, there will be problems, but we self-correct through institutions. But if our institutions are unable to come to the fore, and as Wayne was saying earlier on, you need a lot of money to work through the courts, because the courts have played their role somewhat, but it's not everybody who has that access.
Is it possible to build a tsunami of South Africans that avail themselves for these positions? How can one avail themselves for a position? How does one get on the list for nominations? Could we build a movement of people who overwhelm the system with good skills?
That was another good recommendation from the Zondo Commission, because they talked of vetting. They said for you to qualify for being to be considered, you need to go through a process where you get vetted, where you get obviously interviewed and assessed to say you are fit to sit on a board of a state entity. So that you have a mechanism that doesn't overburden every entity to do everything. And that exactly is where we should start, in my
view. In fact, when nominations were called for the CETA board chairperson's roles, we did exactly that. We went to people that we knew are good directors. We went into LinkedIn and we searched for industry experts, and we asked them, would you put yourself forward for nomination to be a chairperson of this board in that industry or that board? And we got 15 people, and there's 21 seaters, said, I'm happy to put my name forward. Some of them, if I don't fit on this board, I'm happy to sit on that one or that one. So they gave a range. We sent all that through, nominated them to the minister through their process. That wasn't Kabane at the time. She's gone. Buti Manamela is carrying on with it. Those positions, by the way, were supposed to be appointed in March this year. We're in September. It still hasn't happened. There'd been no board. So the CEOs are running amok because they are the de facto board now. And their terms come up for within 6 months, less now. It's a nightmare. We're very interested to see what the minister does, how many of the people we've nominated are appointed as chairpersons. It'll be very interesting, but that's how we've played our part. But you raise a very good point. Maybe it is time for civil society and others collectively to find industry experts in different areas with governance oversight, some from the institute qualifications or certifications, whatever it takes, and have that list there so that any time SABC or whatever is looking for new board members, we can say, well, there's a good list to go through. But I think that's the role of the Institute of Directors. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of good work in that regard. So, yeah, maybe there's something more or different we can do with the Institute as civil society and then cast a very sort of weary eye on government institutions when they don't go to that list.
We're just adding more work on your plate. because quite honestly, I mean, I do often, we want on this platform, that's one of the places we go to say, what can I do? What can I as an individual do differently in addition to support the work that's being done by various organizations, but also to say, I too, I'm going to stand up and be part of a solution.
And that will work very well when we also then put in the system of accountability I was talking about. Mm. So that when you've chosen whoever you've chosen as the authority that does the appointment, you then tell us, this is why this one was the best candidate compared to all of these. And when we know who are the people you are choosing amongst, we are then able to ask you very pointed questions to say, when this one is done, 1, 2, 3, why do you go and appoint so and so who doesn't have this? Because at the moment, it's totally dark. It's invisible. We don't know unless you have put in a name of someone there. When appointments emerge, in fact, you hardly even hear about them. And then you will only see when there is a problem that, oh, so-and-so was in that board, so-and-so was in that board. And then you wonder why, when there were so many other people that could have been considered. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we need a system. And I think I like your suggestion that you might want to look at creating it outside of the formal government structures, but hold government accountable because you already know. But then we must also make sure that when the appointments are done, we are told why people are appointed into those boards. Mm. There must be a justification.
I agree with that.
I think this is a good place to end this conversation. Gentlemen, your insights are amazing. And I think I definitely feel a lot more equipped with some of the information. Because when you read the headlines, some of the stuff doesn't quite land or make sense. And so this conversation has been quite enlightening for me. And thank you for your time. Thank you for your time, Wayne.
Lovely to be here. We love having you here.
And I hope, Dr. Sipho, when Babulu Shaba, when we ask you again, you will make yourself available because your wealth of knowledge has just been fantastic.
Well, it depends,
Nice meeting you too, Wayne. From my side.
Yes.
The Institute's doing good work, so thank you for us.
No, thank you.